Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to talk about spirit, end of life, death. What is a life-limiting illness? How to remain fully alive? And really, are we able to say, I'm not really sure about all of this, but I'm going to run and fear it, and I'm going to be able to say, I don't know what everything is about with end of life. Somebody else will take care of it for me. Or we say, I'm not really sure what I even need to do. What should I be thinking about? What should I be worrying about? Or maybe still, what should I engage in beforehand to just live the best life I can with every day I have? Today, my guest is Judy Flickinger. Her book is Spirit Matters, How to Remain Fully Alive with a Life-Limiting Illness. Judy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
It's my pleasure to be on your show.
Well, thank you, Judy, so much. You know, I think sometimes all of these words that I used in the beginning seem to be tossed around, and some people think that they have it all mastered and they've got all their papers done and their life and their death is going to just go as planned. Others are kind of like shaking it to the wind and saying, have at it. I don't know what to do, so I'll do nothing, right?
Well, first of all, they think that their physicians who are taking care of them for the illness that they're living while they're dying, very often they're not educated about end-of-life care. And the patient thinks that the physician has it under control, and they don't,
right,
because
right,
they're taught how to cure, and that's wonderful if the condition is curable. But we're all going to die, and 90% of us are going to die of a life-limiting illness, a chronic illness, such as cancer, end-stage heart, lung, liver, kidney,
right,
a dementia. A neuromuscular disease. So that's 90% of us that really need to get educated, because I've been doing this work for 29 years, and I have seen so much unnecessary suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm out. I mean, this is my passion, to educate people. And that's why I wrote my book. I wrote it for lay people, because I really wanted them to be educated. My patients, so many of them before they died, they'd say, Judy, please tell others what I didn't know. Because
it
not only drained me, but it drained my family. And it caused suffering for them as well as for me. So that's what I'm all about.
Well, you know what I think also, too, the idea of death, so many times people just plain run from it because they say, oh, I'm not going to die. I'm going to live a long life. And when it shows up at their door, they're like so disheveled and distracted, they don't even know where to go. And then even still, there's others that will say, oh, I have things in place so other people will take care of me. You know, I think the first thing I wanted to start with is such a I had another doctor on. We were talking about end of life, and he and I were saying about our clients. And the biggest concept is that if you've had a physician with you, like maybe for the last 10 years or the last 20 years or whatever, you believe that that physician, quote, knows you and is going to take you from where you are when they first met them all the way to your death door. And that is not true. People end up in a hospital, and then a hospitalist takes over at times. People, they end up, and some other branch of medicine will be taking care of them. And so many times people say, where's my doctor? Where's my doctor that they've entrusted their soul to? and the doctor's nowhere to be found. So I think that's first, the very first concept you can kind of talk about, Judy, is how that really shifts in many cases, and putting our hope, faith, and, you know, our all of our ball of wax into that thought is really an illusion, right?
Well, it isn't if you make a plan. And there's an easy, there's so many easy ways to make a plan. First of all, if you're not letting people know what you want at your end of life, somebody else, when you can't speak for yourself, is going to make a decision about what your end of life will be like. And they might not choose what you would choose.
Right.
So often we saw the kid from California syndrome. There's one kid in the family, might be from another state or just next door, that they want every treatment to continue no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what you would have chosen for yourself. So you need to make these decisions, think about this. And there's a real easy tool to help you do that. It's a fairly new project. It's called the Conversation Project. And you get it online. It's the conversationproject.org. And it's a fill-in-the-blank thing right on the computer. And then you keep that there and make copies for your whoever counts, your physician, your clergy, your kids, whoever's going to be making decisions for you, so that they're not saying what they would want for themselves or making decisions that you wouldn't make. And then you can go in and change it when you want to. Time to do this is not when you're ill. The time to do it is before you get ill.
Absolutely. You know what? I think the idea that everybody believes that they know their family members is such a misnomer. You know, kids grow up, they move away, they go to college, they have a job, they have their own kids, and they say, oh, I know what mom wants or I know what dad wants, when in essence, they haven't been around for the past 10, 20, 30 years. How would they know? You know, I always tell this story, Judy, and I had this one client, and she was in the hospital, and it was pretty clear, you know, that there was time left, maybe a few days, a few weeks maybe, and all the family was gathered, and she says, oh, I'm really hungry. And the daughter said, oh, I know, I'll go get you what you want, Mom, I'll be back. And she leaves, and she comes back, and she has fried chicken in the bucket, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the mother looks at her and says, oh, thank you so much. I was so hungry. I'll eat it a little later. I'm really tired right now, hoping that everybody would leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then after everybody left, she says, I haven't had my teeth in my mouth for 20 years. How the heck am I going to eat fried chicken? You know? And I think, right. But really, what happens is that's a perfect example of what other people believe is truth. Or what other people believe they have in the knowing of someone can be so misconstrued, and at the time when you desperately need it, it isn't there, right?
Well, not only that, but I have a daughter-in-law that's an oncology nurse, and she said you wouldn't believe how many families get in arguments in the hall, in the waiting room. And
or right in front of the patient.
Right in front of the patient, because everyone... Well, I've made it quite clear to my three children what I want, and I told them if they don't comply with this, I'll come back and haunt them because it's really important to me. First of all, I don't want to be in pain, and hospice knows how to manage end of life pain better than anybody else because we've seen what works. We know
it
works. And we know how to manage other symptoms. And to me, I don't want to be in the hospital when I'm dying. Because if you're in the hospital, they have to be doing something to you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're dying, you don't need anybody doing anything except keeping you comfortable and keeping you clean, keeping your family supported. And I said to my kids, you come near me with a can of Ensure. I'm going to spit it out. Bring me a hot fudge sundae as long as I can swallow it.
And if I want
a glass of wine, bring it to me. You know, mm-hmm. Nothing's going to make me better. Keep my spirit going by putting me by a window that I can see the birds and the trees and the flowers mm-hmm. and visit with my friends. Keep me clean. I've gone into homes to admit people to hospice that haven't had a bath in a week or two.
Yep.
Haven't had their linens changed. I want to be clean. My daughter-in-law's promised me, Judy, don't worry. I'll put lipstick on you and I'll keep your hair fixed. When you're dying, I remember one time getting a granddaughter that wanted to do something so bad. Mm-hmm. So we polished her grandma's fingernails.
Right.
It's the little touches that are so important at the end of life. Not being in a, I've had patients in the hospital that have had their arms tied down.
Mm-hmm.
The same because they had tubes in them. Well, those tubes weren't going to make them better. And they just wanted those tubes out and their arms untied. And they wanted to go home.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's really difficult to make that arrangement for people. But I was very tenacious. And I got people out of the hospital that, I just had them sign forms against, the physicians didn't want them to go or the patient wanted to go.
Right.
And they were dying. So they need, you need to be where you want to be. And I want to be home or in a home-like setting. We do hospice in nursing homes, in assisted living. Mm-hmm. We have hospice houses. We even took care of a man in his car, a homeless man.
Right.
He wanted to be, that's where he wanted to be. So we went and visited him, took care of him in his car. He wouldn't leave his car. You lose control of everything when you're dying. So I always tried to make sure my patients were as in much control as they could possibly be to make them feel like a human being.
Judy, let's talk for a second about anger, because I think that, when you said about the hands tied down and all, I think who in their right mind would say that they don't have anger when they're feeling like they're dying? Do you know what I mean? I think everybody's pretty well pissed off and is really mad, at some point, And I think to say that you're not and you're ready for it, that might be the point of acceptance, but initially, I think everyone feels that, don't you think? And I think to talk about that is really vitally important, because a lot of people will say, well, I don't want to show I'm angry to my friends or my kids or my doctor because, I don't know what will happen. But, hey, I think that to be able to understand that, it comes up a lot in end-of-life care. It comes up in a lot in hospice. People are very angry, right?
Absolutely. And, I put a little saying in my book, I call it presencing. And presencing is being in the moment with that dying person and letting them spill all over you, their anger, their fears, their frustrations. And once that occurs, it's a special thing. And once that occurs and they get that out, they can go on living.
Yeah.
And it makes such a tremendous difference. But, one of the things that people say to me, well, I do have my living will. Well, the living will is fine, but you need this conversation with your family and your clergy and your physician. In fact, you need to sit down with your physician and say, this is what is acceptable to me if I should get a life-limiting illness. And one of the things I told my physician is, I don't want to be in a hospital. I want to be home. And I want to be on hospice because then I won't have to come and sit in your office in the waiting room for an hour to see you. The nurse will take care of all that. And I can use my energy, which will be very limited as I'm living with this illness, to do what I want to do. What people don't realize, I sent patients on vacation that were on hospice. A couple people went back to work that were on hospice.
Right.
Lets people use their energy for what they want to use it for, but you have to get, you have to be admitted to hospice soon enough so that can happen. And it's not happening. I've been doing this for so long, and we're not getting people in early enough so they can go on living. We get them on death's door, and there's not too much we can do except make them comfortable.
Today we discuss many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.
Can we talk about for a second when you say about being at home? Because a lot of times it may be what you and I might want. We may be having all of our papers and all of our things in alignment. And you may say, oh, well, my spouse said that they'll help me. But then all of a sudden your spouse dies and you're by yourself and there is no one to help you. Or like you said in the beginning of the conversation, other relatives show up and they have no clue. And I'll tell you, I know from my work with many people that sometimes the people around them are the ones that have the issues with the dying in the process, and they tend to not be able to care for you. They don't want to see you if you're drooling. They don't want to see you if you're taking your last breath. They don't want to see you in pain. They don't want to help you use the restroom. You know, they don't want any part of that, you know, and I think that's potentially where a lot of things get off the rails, don't you think?
I do, and yet that's when hospice is most valuable, because, I mean, I spent my time as a hospice nurse educating the caregivers about what was going on. Sometimes they don't know. Mm-hmm. They see these changes, but they don't know what it means, and nobody's telling them. And the caregiver's frightened. So I spent my time teaching and how to take care of them and supplementing that care with members of the hospice team. I mean, we had a nurse's aide that came in and gave baths and cleaned the patients, you know, took care of their personal needs. So the caregiver didn't have to do that if that wasn't something that they felt they could do.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I really want to mention is the wrong thing to say to a physician is, would you, if for the dying person or the caregiver, is it time for hospice? Because most physicians don't know when it's time for hospice, and that's why we keep getting people in. So the question should be, would you be surprised if I or my loved one who has ever dealing with this illness were to die in the next months? And the physician says, no, I wouldn't be surprised. And this person's living with a life-limiting illness, then I'm here to tell you, it's time for hospice.
Right.
And once you get on hospice, you can always go off of it if you start improving and you know. But once you get on, you'll find, I've never had a family say to me after a death, I wish I wouldn't have done this. Never.
Right.
The only thing I hear, and I've heard this on my travels, why didn't anybody tell me about this wonderful service before now? I needed this help for so long. And Jeanine, it's free.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't get charged for it. Why wouldn't you take advantage of it?
Yeah, and I think also, too, the idea of palliative care coming up, too, now, is the idea of start to, they're like, oh, well, I think the physicians really, when they hear hospice, they're like, they're transitioning their care, so then the doctor feels like a failure, or he feels like whatever that might be. You know, they have their own situations, or, you know, they're afraid to let the patient go because they feel like there's still hope or whatever. But then also, too, with palliative care, it's almost like doctors don't even know about that or what that even means. And I always say to people, okay, you have a real, you're crashing, you feel like you're standing at the cement wall, and it's like, okay, fabulous, let's do this. Get you help. And that's what I call hospice and palliative care. You don't, they're not, there's no label designed on it. What they are you having trouble walking up the stairs? Yes, call palliative care. Are you having trouble eating? Yes, call hospice and palliative care. Do you need a little help getting your prescriptions? Call them. I said, they're called the helpers when you need help. And I think that's the most important thing. If you can just say that, is that they're there to help you in your time of need, period. And don't even go into anything else. You know, people will say, oh, okay, I need this. I need that. I need a toilet seat. I need rails in my bathroom. I need a walker. You know what I'm saying? All of a sudden, all of their needs come to fruition because they're finally able to voice them, right?
Well, not exactly, because there's certain criteria to be part of a hospice program. You have to have a life-limiting illness with a life expectancy of 6 months.
But it kind of dwindles their illusion of it. Do you know what I'm saying? In other words...
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
And, you know, this whole business about physicians, and I'm not here to knock physicians.
Their job is just
wonderful physicians, and I've worked with not so wonderful physicians. Mm-hmm. But they did a study at Stanford University Medical School, and they interviewed 1,800, they did a survey. They interviewed 1,800 physicians, and 98% of them said they would not want curative care if they had a life-limiting illness. I mean, isn't that amazing when you stop and think of how much, I call it futile care. When you think of all the Alzheimer's patients that are in a nursing home, that they keep sitting, you know, they keep sending them back and forth to the hospital with urinary tract infections and pneumonias, and it's like a revolving door, and it's costing us billions of dollars. And it scares them to death to take them out of their environment in the nursing home, put them in an ambulance, and they ended up in the emergency room, and the lights are blinking, and they're scared to death.
Right.
And then they stabilize them there after they've laid on a gurney and take them to ICU because they're spiking this high fever, and they get rid of that, and they send them to the nurse's unit, and they spend a week there or so, and they get an ambulance, take them back to the nursing home, and it happens all over again.
Right.
And it's just a revolving door, and it's causing more harm than good for that patient, plus the family. I mean, it's exhausting to be the family of an Alzheimer's patient and making those decisions. With hospice, we just keep them in the nursing home and keep comfortable and let that infection be their final event. And as long as they're comfortable, I don't know, for me, you know, it's time to let go.
Right.
I mean, I don't want my children and my husband to have to suffer through that over and over and over again. I'm not going to get better. And I don't want to drain our healthcare dollars like that. This unnecessary suffering is an important issue.
I think the idea of what is the end of life supposed to look like. In other words, when do you say, I'm closing my book, my chapter is done, and what's next, is really a place where there's been no conversation, because our society is really all about anti-aging, anti-this, antibiotics, we need to get out there, we need to run more, we need to do everything for prevention. And really, it's not anything at all about when things happen, then what? You know what I'm saying? In other words, we've always front-ended our conversation, and we've not given any consideration to the rest of it, right?
That's exactly true, and that's what my book is about. It's almost a personal trainer. What do you need to know? And I'm not talking about financial issues. That's a whole nother ball game. I'm talking about medical issue. And what we're finding is, as technology gets better, dying has gotten worse.
Right.
We're like the ever-ready batteries. They can keep us going. But how much suffering is that causing? I got a call a couple years ago from a friend of mine, and we live in a retirement community. And she said, Judy, I met this lady, and we got to talking, and she told me that her husband had cancer, and I was telling her about my friend that wrote this wonderful book. And she said she had read it. And she said she wanted us if you would meet with her. So I did. And she told me this story. She said, Judy, my husband was diagnosed with end-stage cancer. And she said he was very active. She said he played golf almost every day. That was his life.
Right.
And he started getting chemo treatments. And she said he spent his life with his head in the toilet. And he had no energy. He was miserable. And she said, someone gave us your book. And she said, I read it, and I gave it to him, and he read it. And he said, you know, this chemo's just making me miserable, and it's causing me more suffering than the cancer. So I'm going to stop it. And she said, he started playing golf. He played golf every day for 3 months. She said, we've never been happier. She said, our kids came down at Christmas, and we had a wonderful Christmas together. And she said he was feeling pretty good. And then they left, went back home. And she said his condition started deteriorating. And he played golf once or twice a week, and then finally couldn't play anymore. And she said he died. But she said, Judy, you gave him back our lives, because we started going to show again and out to dinner. Mm-hmm. To me, that's the best it gets, you know?
Right. It's really about enjoying living until your living is done. Do you know
that's
what I'm saying?
Right.
In other words, do we vacate our bodies, our spirit, and say, you know, I'm out of here, and then just kind of leave this body alone in whatever form it is to be able to finish up our existence?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in a way, sometimes, honestly, our soul and our spirit do vacate. I truly believe sometimes when you look at people when they're very being held on to for so long, you know, and in these different situations, I really truly believe that their soul sometimes is gone. And we are just sitting there taking care of the body. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I personally believe their spirit goes, who they are as a person inside of them. Because we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience.
Right.
And keeping that inner spirit alive and well, that's what I'm all about. Throughout life, and especially at the end of life, and it's possible. But you need help, and nobody gives that help as well as hospice. I don't believe, and I've been in all areas of medicine. And the reason I started doing hospice is because I was taking care of a little old lady in the hospital, and she said to me, Judy, please don't let them pounce on me and try to put paddles on me.
Right.
If I die while I'm here, that's okay, honey. So I said, you want me to get an order for the physician that they won't do that to you? She said, I would be really grateful. So I went out the desk and I talked to the physician. He said, I absolutely will not write that order, because she's not dying. So I went back and told her, and she was so upset.
Yeah, I know.
And so the next day she said, would you try again? And I did. Mm-hmm. He refused to write the order. And about 3 days later, I was working, and I heard over the PA system get the crash card for room such and such, which I knew was her room. And I was at the desk, so I ran after the crash card. And Janine, I ran it down the hall to her room, and her door was open, and there were people pounding on her, and her little naked body was laying there on a board on the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sick. It made me nauseous.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is so unnecessary. They had therapists there, respiratory mm-hmm. therapists, IV therapists, interns, mm-hmm. physicians. Oh, it was just filled. Her room was filled with people pounding on her. And I cried all the way home that day. And I said, I won't be a part of this anymore. I didn't become a nurse to be a part of this. This is criminal. And that's when I decided to become a hospice nurse. And it's been my favorite job. It's been my hardest job because it's very tiring with all the emotional issues. But I loved it, and I loved my patients. And I still today, I go out and give speeches trying to educate people, and I do these radio interviews, and I really encourage people. I mean, my book is only $13, and it's a simple book to read, and yet it's filled with knowledge. It would make a great gift for a nursing student or a medical student, because they're not going to learn this in medical school. And it's so important because people die all the time. And this can make a difference in their practice of medicine.
And, you know, I think the biggest thing is to have a conversation at different increments of time in your life. Because if you turn around and wait until the very end, you know, you're kind of like having issues with, oh, my gosh, she already has, Alzheimer's. Now the issue is the papers are no longer valid, you know. So you know how that goes. Or they're already sick and they're already on medications, and then they aren't valid anymore. In other words, they can't speak for themselves. They can't make a decision that's a legal decision. So I think really the idea is, if you put something down on paper, no matter what your age is getting it started and just to continue. Even the books, you know, the five wishes, I'm sure you remember that. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. It's about doing something and putting it on paper. So, and having it around the house. A lot of people say to me, oh, I put it in my safe. I said, well, let me tell you, your safe is God knows where. Your key is I don't know where. And they need an answer right now, and it's called 30 seconds. You know? I tell people that, you know, elders, you know, if you're going to rehab, make sure rehab has a copy. If you're going here, have a copy there. If someone's given you a ride or you're going to some other therapies or whatever, put it in your purse. You know, have these things with you, because a lot of times people don't know that. How many times, you know, as elders, you know, they're really not having any relatives around them that live by them, and other people are instituted for their care. You know, like maybe giving them rides or doing this, that, or the other, and they have no idea how to even help them. I say, if you've got it in your purse, at least you have it on your person, you know. Or I even tell people, put it on your refrigerator. You know, when the EMS comes to your house, they want to know, does anyone else live here? The first thing they look at is the refrigerator. Then they know if you've got a spouse or kids. You know, remember when people used to put pictures on the refrigerator?
Sure.
Well, yeah, I always tell them, put your emergency papers on top of the refrigerator. EMS is going to pass there. They're going to look. That's, you know, I train people to tell them that's the number one thing. Put your important papers there. You know, when I talk to EMS people, I say, hey, first thing you do is if you're picking up somebody, go to look at that refrigerator. You'll know a story of something there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about, a lot of times people say, I had my papers, but then I couldn't get to them, or people didn't know about them. Don't you think we run that risk also, too?
Well, we run so many risks, you're right. And this conversation project, you can keep You fill it out online and you just fold it, print it out, and put that in your purse. To me, that spells an awful lot about what you want and where you want to be, who you want there. Just to me, that answers so many questions for people. I tried so hard to have this conversation with my adult children, and my oldest son just wouldn't talk about it. And I had to get really firm with him because this I've seen too much, and I don't want to be one of these people that has all this unnecessary suffering. I know that it's just not it's not necessary, and it's so debilitating when you're dying in pain or if you're dying. I mean, I had people that had been discharged from the hospital, Janine, that hadn't had a bowel movement in 2 weeks. Well, that causes pain, too. So, hospice takes care of all those needs and keeps you comfortable. And to me, when I could get someone's spirit back by taking good care of them, it was just such a joy to be their nurse, to see them smiling again and getting back in their lives and maybe meeting a friend for lunch rather than going sitting in a doctor's office for a few hours. Because when you're dying, you'd only have so much energy.
Right.
And, I would kind of direct them to use their energy for what they wanted to use it for and let me take care of the rest.
And also, too, the idea that even people say, oh, I have caregivers, I'm good to go, my caregivers are all lined up and blah, blah, blah. Well, caregivers get kind of scared at the end, too, Caregivers are like, oh, I don't want this on my back. Oh, I don't know what to do. Oh, I haven't seen that before. Oh, all of a sudden the family started coming in again. Or, oh, the person, they said they wanted this and now they changed their mind and I'm only a caregiver. What do I do? So I think the idea that even caregivers have to have things in place to be able to support them, because even when you're giving those last three doses of morphine in a period of 2 to 3 hours or 4 hours or whatever, you're going, oh, I can't handle this. You got to have some backup. And I think to have backup is important, right?
Well, not only that, but with hospice, we're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, holidays. You just pick up the phone and call hospice, and a nurse will either come to your house or talk to you over the phone.
Talk you through it,
Yes. And, I made many middle-of-the-night visits and telephone calls. And sometimes people just need, to hear a professional say, you're doing well. Yeah, go ahead and give that other dose of morphine. That's okay. They need to know that it's okay and they're doing a good job. I felt it was an important part of my job to be affirmative to those caregivers because that is a tremendous job. You're tired, you're nervous, you're fearful. Besides, your heart's broken. You're losing someone you love. And to get all that support that you get through hospice, to me, it is so valuable. And that's what the families tell you. It's just so valuable.
And also, too, to be able to prepare for that time, because I think sometimes people start saying, oh, we need to get a camera. We need to watch the legalities here. I don't want them to let my person die, when really the person is already in the process of dying. I think that's a huge statement, yes?
It is, plus the fact, with hospice, we know they're dying, so, there's no need for that person to be concerned about that because that's a given, or we wouldn't be in there, So that takes that burden away. There's so many things, burden-wise and fear-wise and whatnot, that just go away, that you don't have to clutter your mind with your heart or your spirit as a caregiver. Because we saw spirits in our caregivers that were just so depleted, and they were exhausted. And to get the help that they needed, And it doesn't cost anything. The only thing that it costs when you're in hospice is if you have to go into a hospice house. You have to pay your room and board. And they do that, many of them, on a sliding scale. And it's a wonderful program. And as I said, if it doesn't serve your needs, you just ask to be discharged. And if you don't like the nurse that you're seeing, you just fire her and get another one, or fire the person.
Right.
The hospice program you're in, and get another one if you don't like them. You're in charge. You are in charge.
I think when people come to that time in their life, they say, I've now given control of my life over to everyone and everything else. And that's when we see their sheer quest for life kind of idea, or maybe their idea of life, or maybe their thoughts that their life has really ended on that moment. I really think that's where sometimes people say, my life ended that day, and they can give you the day, the date, and the time, right, and exactly what they were doing and what they were wearing. They know when their life, they felt, was over, right?
Well, if they don't, see, we saw their lives restored to them when they got in hospice good enough, early enough.
Right.
It really did, Janine. It was like a reawakening. Oh,
yeah.
Just like that man that I was talking about that went back to playing golf. I mean, he felt his life was over. He wasn't able to do what he loved to do. And he got to do it. And he felt so much better than when he was on that chemo that wasn't going to do anything good for him anyway.
Yeah.
So it's just things people need to think about. And
tons of prescriptions, you know what I'm saying? The ones
sure.
to save them. Once they start getting off of them, sometimes some people get a little bit better for quite a while. And
mm-hmm.
it's sort of like, oh, man, I finally got all of that crap out of my body. And then people say, oh, I never felt so different in so many years, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's a tough journey, Judy, I think, to be able to say, stand up and say, I know I'm going to die, I'm okay with it, and I'm going to live till the end of the moment. And then something shatters that illusion, and they feel like they've lost it. So I think our conversations today and speaking about, there are many times that you can get help, there are many times you can prepare, and there's many times that you can say, reach out and I'd like something else. It's really about giving their strength back at that time, right?
In our spirit, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the secret, keeping your spirit alive.
Absolutely. Well, Judy, it was such a pleasure to speak with you today. Could you share with the listeners how to find out more information about you?
Well, they can go on my website. It's www.spiritmattersauthor.com. And my book's available through Amazon. And it's Spirit Matters, How to Remain Fully Alive with a Life-Limiting Illness. And if they would go on the Amazon site and look at some of the reviews, they've just been wonderful. It's really touched me what people are saying about my book. So I hope people will peruse that and get educated.
Well, Judy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
And I feel the same way. Thank you, Janine.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye.
If you'd like to find out more information about Judy Flickinger, again, her book is Spirit Matters. Please do click on the link on the bottom of today's show page, and you go directly to her website. And really, it is about being able to say, you know what, I am okay, I'm going to be well, and I will do the best I can with this life I've been given. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Till tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.